Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power,
fueling the mischief in the beautiful game.
Gamble responsibly. See dunlewy.net.
All right, you're welcome along to Thursday's football show. Nathan Murphy with you this evening. Now, this book has just been released. Champagne Football is out today. John Delaney and the Betrayal of Irish Football, the inside story from Sunday Times journalists Mark Tighe and Paul Ronan. Delighted that Mark Tighe is alongside me in studio. How are you keeping?
Great, yeah, thanks.
Big day, it's out, it's in bookshops now.
Yeah, literally just been up Grafton Street and on Dawson Street and Hodgson Figs, and fantastic to see it on the shelves at last, and people, you know, snapping it up. It's a fantastic feeling today, yeah.
It's obviously, 18 months now since the first revelation started to come out around John Delaney?
Yeah, so like March 1st was when, as we detailed in Champagne Football, we talk about, I came back from the Dennis O'Brien case, which I'd been covering against the Business Post for a month, and next thing, it was late on a Friday, and on my desk was this envelope to kind of change my career, I suppose, but also John Delaney's, and inside were two pieces of paper about the €100,000. And so over the next 2 weeks, he worked on that story, standing it up. And at the last minute, John Delaney took a High Court injunction application against us and me, at Sunday Times, and me personally. And thankfully, we prevailed in quite a heated and dramatic circumstances, with Judge Anthony Barr saying there was huge significant public interest in transactions between the CEO of the FAI and the FAI. And since then, I suppose, that kind of established my bona fides with a lot of people, and some whistleblowers came forward, further whistleblowers, and we got a lot of good stories and kind of exposing a lot of the madness that had been going on with the FAI's finances.
So had you any sense on day one when that envelope arrives on your desk that this is going to be the start of the house of cards starting to crumble?
No, not at all. Like the way things escalated so quickly, like within a week of the story, Delaney was stepping aside into the role of executive vice president in that mad night in Gibraltar, Mick McCarthy's first game in charge.
I was there not looking at the match, looking over John Delaney and trying to read into exactly what his movements were and what it all meant.
Yeah, so like over the years, myself and Paul had worked together on a lot of stories about Delaney, and you know, we'd always, there'd been a whiff of sulfite off him, and we weren't impressed with the way he was handling things and the secrecy. He wasn't answering questions, basic questions. At one press event in CHQ where they're launching the Euro 2020 logo, he shuttled past me rather than stay and answer a question, as I've been assured that he would. It was just a question about the FAI's financial deals with, I think, with a Cork Centre of Excellence. But you know, he was afraid of hard questions. You could see this over the years. He was focusing on doing interviews, not to be insulting, but you know, with celebrity kind of journalists, you know, like Barry Egan.
Well, he'd become a celebrity.
Well, that's it. He saw himself. So he was on like the Ray Darcy show or Brendan O'Connor show, talking about his love life and these things. And you know, but he wouldn't sit down with you know, journalists who were asking hard questions. So.
No, there were many years where he didn't sit down with any soccer writers.
So I remember when he sat down with you guys over the 2019 accounts, or the 2018 accounts.
Yeah, which I think was the last time, certainly, I spoke to John Delaney, which was at the time, again, there was a issue within the FAI away from the accounts, which was there were another...
With the PFAI.
With the PFAI around wages being paid in Limerick, but it was the day of the accounts. So he did sit down that day alongside Eamon Breen and said... Yes, 2020, we have a decision to make, but we're on course to be debt-free.
And that was like a mantra from John Delaney, that we would be debt-free by 2020. But if you asked anyone who could look at the accounts, go, hang on, what? There's some strange stuff here. You know, there's a lot of money here, debt accruing, you know, from future revenue. This, you know, I don't see how this works up, that this bank debt can suddenly be wiped out by 2020. You know, there's no magic pill here. So when we got the tip off, going back to your first question, I straight away thought, well, hang on, there's never been a crack in the edifice, you know, the facade that John Delaney had out there, that the FAI's finance were in good shape. And here we were, we weren't sure what we had exactly, but we suspected that there was a possible breach of company law, and that as soon as we checked the accounts for 2017, there was no declaration, you know, of a director's loan of any type. And you thought, well, you know, okay, it's not a hanging crime, but that's something that should be there for transparency's sake. And by company law, it should be there. And so that, at the very least, that's what we suspected, you know, that they hadn't declared this unusual transaction. And the fact that John Delaney could pay €100,000 into the FAI, it suggested all sorts of things, that the FAI was broke. And that did prove to be the case.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that then, because so that day, when I sat down with John Delaney, again, looking at the figures initially, it was very much in continuation of previous year's figures, and everyone's wondering, is this 2020 deadline going to be met? But it's 6 months later that, as you said, there's the 100,000 loan. But also, very quickly, within a week, in and around that Gibraltar game, like the FAI are having discussions about not having enough money to send another 21 side to Armenia. So had it got to breaking point that even if this story hadn't come out, that the FAI's financial issues were going to emerge in the coming months anyways, or does everything you discovered suggest that actually they would have found a way around this?
I think it would have happened, but maybe not for another 12 to 18 months. I think, if you know, like when he got to this time, and everyone would say, well, hang on, you haven't cleared the debt. Like, he never would have cleared the debt, but he could have kept the plate spinning for maybe another year, I think. And he was doing that by drawing down future revenue streams, and you can only do that for a certain amount of time. So, but what happened, and I think it was inspired or prompted by the revelations, and which blew a big hole in the FAI's finances, and which may or may not have happened with her stories, was Sports Direct money. So this was Mike Ashley, the Newcastle United owner, had agreed a deal with the FAI for $6.5 million worth of sponsorship. So that was money the FAI banked. So there's
so big razzmatazz, new sponsorship deal, $6.5 million coming into the into the association.
Well, that's the way John Delaney told the board. It wasn't really publicly. It wasn't no one knew that actually that money was key to. For the FAI transferring their debt from a very high interest and punitive rate with KKR, an American private equity firm, into Bank of Ireland. So that deal only happened because of Mike Ashley's $6.5 million. But what nobody knew outside of John Delaney and maybe one or two other senior people was that there was a clause, basically, that Mike Ashley had just been given a free bet on the FAI in that he could take that $6.5 million back without any ifs, buts, or whatever, even though he was getting the sponsorship off the
So how long was the sponsorship deal for?
Well, the sponsorship deal was up to 2020,
right.
But there was a clause, an amazing clause, which only John Delaney and Mike Ashley can explain how the FAI agreed to it, or how John Delaney agreed to it, that Mike Ashley could get that money back up to April 2020, no questions asked. And that's what he did.
We get the full $6.5 million.
$6.5 million.
Regardless if the sponsorship has gone ahead for 2 years.
Exactly. So he's accrued all this benefit. You know, Sports Direct is. If you see any kid with a summer camp gear, it'll have Sports Direct splashed upon it. And he got the box. I don't know how often he used the corporate box in the Aviva. That was part of the deal as well. Another part, which was never activated, was that he would have title sponsor of the Abbottstown Training Centre where the national team and other teams use. So he got those two benefits at least, but he got all his money. He asked for all his money back. So like when we spoke to directors and people, they were like, when they heard that Mike Ashley was looking for the money back, they're like, tell him to go and run and jump. Yeah. You know, that's the joke. And they looked at the contract and the clauses in the contract, the side contract, saying, "Oh, this is what's stipulated. He can demand this money back. We have to pay it back." So the FAI are now paying €100,000 a month back, and included with interest, it's an enormous amount of money owed back. So that blew a huge hole in the FAI's finances, and that meant the house of cards was effectively had crumbled.
Looking just slightly away from John Delaney, because the book is all around John Delaney, but you talk about the directors there and if he acted alone, how he managed to get away with this for so many years, who knew what and when. Mm-hmm. You do come away from a lot of it actually realizing that the directors were in the dark, that a huge amount of the directors were in the dark for all of this. So were they just asleep at the wheel?
Yeah, a lot of them were asleep, you know, very good people, and actually people that they had some corporate and governance experience, you know, like people like Niamh O'Donoghue, although she joined the board only, I think it was 2018. You know, she was the Secretary General of one of the biggest government departments, Department of Social Protection. She went in there and she asked some hard questions. She said, like, they had this system in the FAI where they'd only get the John Delaney would present this 30-page, big whack of a document of his monthly CEO's report, and it would talk about all the clubs he'd visited. It would talk about you know, who he went to dinner with, you know, if he met any politicians. It was extremely detailed, and so they were kind of blown away by this, blinded, you know, by science almost. You know, but if you dug in, and I've seen these reports, you know, the debt is always like, things are tight, you know, creditors are being managed, you know, and that was the extent of kind of the financial update he would give them. And then he'd give them, you know, huge updates on the under-21s, training camps, disputes between the Leinster Senior League and someone else. So all these other issues were there in close detail every month. And the directors and most of them are football people, like people like Jim McConnell up in Donegal, or Mick Hanley from Limerick. You know, they're there mainly, you know, to mind their patch, like Ulster football, make sure they're getting their cut of everything, and there's nothing improper happening.
So are they out of their debt? Because obviously, you know, when we talk about the governance of the FAI, there are a lot of changes happening and a lot more probably to happen. And one of the points that's raised is that the FAI is a big, big business now. Mm. That a lot of these people started out as volunteers, and suddenly there's a 50 million euro debt right now there at minimum that needs to be paid back, that they're dealing with huge sums of money. And the amount of money when you go into it, like there was a credit card that was 300-400 grand a month on it at times.
Yeah.
Like that, for those, that the government structures had just broken down completely.
Yeah, like one of the most jaw-dropping findings, if we detail some of the COSI analysis, the COSI were the accountants sent in by Sport Ireland to look at the FAI's books. They found that up to 2 million euro of the FAI's money was going through credit cards every year. So basically, like normal procurement, you know, you'd send in an invoice and you get paid. That wasn't the way it worked with the FAI. They were managing creditors through credit card payments, you know, and John Delaney wasn't even the biggest spender on his credit card. Now, not to say the spending was improper, but it was just, it's a ridiculous way for a company to be behaving, that if you're booking like the Irish under 21s going off to Armenia, you know, put it all on the credit card. That's right. Not a proper way of functioning. So that was happening with the FAI. Everything was put on credit cards, and then credit cards were abused as well. In the case of John Delaney, you know, there was a personal expenditure of 125,000 euro a year found over the last 5 years. But your point about, like, John O'Regan, who's from Kerry, he was one of John Delaney's biggest supporters.
Whenever very vocal, when the tide had totally turned against John Delaney, so he was still very vocal in support.
And up to this day, his point would be that, you know, these directors were in the room with John. They failed. You know, if John erred, so be it, but they should have stopped him, you know, for so long. So that's what, you know, that's an interesting point of view, you know, you have to say he's correct in a lot of ways, that people like the all the presidents especially, I think, have to look at themselves. And, you know, we interviewed Donald Conway, who puts his hands up and say, yeah, I failed here, we all failed, you know, John.
Because they do come across at times as you end up being quite sympathetic towards some of the directors, but at the same time, even when the shit is hitting the fan that week in Gibraltar, most of them don't want him to go. Most of them are agreeable to whatever John Delaney comes up with that Hall report, whatever change in title, they were fully supportive. So, yeah, they got to take ownership of this.
They do. And like some of them will say now, look, that's what we were telling John, but you know, our long-term game was to move him out of CEO and we get someone else in, and this is a way of facilitating. But then you're like, hang on, you wrote out a new contract for him on hotel-headed notepaper, The Rock, Gibraltar, setting out how he'd get 360,000 euro for the rest of that year, 9 months, and then he'd get a 100,000 euro salary and 200,000 euro bonus and loads of other, you know, add-ons, possibly in his new EVP role. Like, how is that good corporate governance to agree that now? Like Donald Conway talks about being pressured into that, you know, and the way that was done in a hotel room, and it's something, you know, he obviously has big regret about doing now. And but it's one example of how John was a very forceful individual, and he bent a lot of people to his will, you know, and as one of the key facilitators of him, and, you know, his kind of consigliere down the years, was a guy called Michael Cody from Cork, a former FPD executive, very senior executive in FPD, but a man like who's 80 years old now, and he was company secretary. So he's the guy under the FAI rules is supposed to guard the FAI rule book, you know, make sure everything is done properly. So when you talk to some of the other directors, they say, well, look, we trusted Michael. You know, Michael might have had John's side, but he would have, you know, when he saw John doing stuff that, you know, being too aggressive against people or the media, Michael would put the brakes on, you know. So we always thought Michael is minding
a certain level of control.
Yeah, Michael is minding the house, you know, that we can trust Michael. Like, Michael wouldn't be shy about talking about his great experience and maybe downplaying other people's corporate experience on the FAI board. Like, one person told me that, you know, he had no time for Niamh O'Donoghue because she was a public servant, you know.
Right.
That's a common thing with private sector people would say.
So it wasn't a united board?
Oh, far from it, yeah. Like, there were factions, you know, definitely, but so many of them were there for so long, you know. That's why, you know, John Delaney repeatedly refused requests and demands from people on the outside to put on independent directors, and you can see why that is now.
It's no surprise to read at the weekend that Fianna Fáil thought of him as a potential candidate, because a lot of this does read as old school politics. He conquered the grassroots. I think you touch on, he started a routine of, on his way up and down to Dublin, even at a very early stage, started making five calls on the way up, five calls on the way down to the real grassroots, so that he had that base there. Yet he was very comfortable with the higher echelons of Irish society, with the celebrity side of Irish society. The one thing he struggled with was the supporters, that he wanted their love.
He did, desperately.
He just could never get it.
Desperately. And he had a clique of supporters who backed him, you know, and we talk about it kind of like in the game in Denmark, the horrible nil-all draw, I think was it our house? And, you know, there was
the day Martin O'Neill sacked.
Yeah, just before that. And, you know, there was a clique of Delaneyites who were, you know, grabbing at the supporters who were holding up Delaneyite banners, you know. So he had these loyal supporters who he treated very well. He'd look after them no matter what. You know, he'd have them as ball boys behind doors, friendly, right, against Northern Ireland, you know. But back in the early days, like Wybig were one of the big protagonists in this story. You know, the you boys in green, they were like a loose grouping of football supporters, and a lot of them got into the corporate governance issues. Like, we quote Zeno Kelly as a guy who was raising concerns, you know, and like he felt the wrath, you know. Like he was being searched by the FAI and security when he went abroad. He'd go to nearly every home game. He got banned from the Aviva Stadium for stuff he posted on forums. You know, one of the documents we got shows that there was even emails going out to the guards or to Delaney suggesting that, you know, there was a WhatsApp group and the Gardaí were looking at hacking it. You know, it's preposterous stuff. You know, when you're like, and you know, any kind of dissent then from the fans was crushed. You know, that famous USA game where you had very heavy handed stewarding and the Gardaí going in to take any banners off. And like, I remember, it's not in the book, but one security guard told me that they had drummers in the Aviva, and you know, if a Delaney out chant was to go up,
the drums would go up.
Yeah,
tell the drummers
to belt one out there.
Like, as you flick through it, you could stop at any page, and there's just an insane story that you wouldn't believe. And I'm always wary of getting into the celebrity side of it, because like, there's a very serious side of this as well, which is the FAI is 50 million in debt. There's hundreds of people working out there who've living through this and are worried for their jobs and are in a position where they are worried of their jobs because
of all...
And
the state has had to bail out.
Exactly. One of the stories, the story of the credit union ad around Roy Keane and Martin O'Neill, again, is just a real reflection of how the FAI was run differently to every other footballing organisation. What happened there?
Yeah, so it's procurement and I suppose two of the big areas. Procurement is where you get money in, or you're spending money, and then also sales. And for the FAI, you know, sales is basically a lot of it, and if it's not ticking, is marketing and selling the corporate brand of the FAI. So when John Delaney got Martin O'Neill and Roy Keane in, he thought this was a dream ticket. You know, this is going to bring home the bacon. Like, these guys are, you know, corporate Ireland love them. And so you might remember the credit union, Irish League of Credit Unions, previously had Brian O'Driscoll and doing an ad for them where he runs through a credit union, and he had all Ireland appeal, and they saw Martin O'Neill and Roy Keane, perfect.
You know, box office.
Yeah, he covers Northern Ireland, Roy Keane covers Cork, you know, this is brilliant. So, FAI agreed, the boys have to do this under their contract, do commercial work for the FAI. But the problem was, they were at a pre-season tournament pre-season friendlies over in America, and Martin O'Neill didn't get to see the script for the two commercials until very late, and when he saw it, he hated it. And, you know, he said, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do the ads. But what happened was the FAI, under John Delaney, said, look, you could do the ads, please do the ads, and you have a veto. If you don't like it, the end result, the ads won't grow.
Right.
So the FAI took in €100,000 from the FAI, or from the credit unions, an upfront payment. They shot these ads. One ad was a dream sequence where Martin O'Neill was a teller in a credit union. The other ad is where Roy Keane is a Zen master pruning a bonsai tree and kind of telling Martin, you know, breathe in, breathe out. You know, so they flipped the personalities. The credit union, they were assured afterwards that, you know, the FAI said, go ahead, yeah, book the slots, do all your production. The ads were put together, you know, the credit unions loved it and had booked the slots to go on TV. And no, Martin's not happy. The FAI said, look, we'll return the 100K. But you can't broadcast this. And the credit union had already spent a huge amount of money, double that. And there was threats and counter-threats, legal action, and eventually the FAI folded and had to repay the money and all the production costs to the credit union.
Don't mess with Martin O'Neill, it turns out.
Well, like, I've no issue with Martin O'Neill. Like, he was given a veto and he used it, you know, and it was just crazy for the FAI under Delaney to take money and to enter into a commercial arrangement with a sponsor like that under those conditions, you know, where the manager hadn't signed on and given its approval.
So where did it all go wrong then? Because, like, everybody suspected there were issues and everybody knew that the Vantage Club sales hadn't gone right. And as you say, you know, there were people within football asking a lot of questions, but there were no interviews forthcoming. The financial figures would come and everything would look like it was just ticking along all right. Was it the Ray Darcy interview? Was it the 5 million from Blatter? Was that the moment that it all started to unravel, that suddenly government figures, people from the outside, needed access to the accounts?
He managed to bluff his way through the whole Sepp Blatter 5 million issue. You know, like it looked terrible. You know, the world's media were focusing because just the timing of it was terrible. It showed kind of John Delaney's arrogance, I think, that he could go on there and kind of boast about this on Ray Darcy. And it was interesting that, you know, he'd been asked the question repeatedly because the Sun had actually done the story a year previously, and he'd always, you know, played a straight bat and denied the questions. Had this money being paid or what was it for? And next thing on Ray Darcy, you know, he's
relaxed.
Yeah, like, and that was the funny thing, you know, Ray Darcy played it perfectly. You know, he almost played the fool, the knave. You know, what's going on here? And next thing, John, you know, lets the ball drop. Yeah, that money was paid. Stop us taking legal action. You've named a figure. Well done there, you know, like laughing and boasting about how Sepp Blatter had ogled up his girlfriend. But he managed to bluff his way through that. You know, it was remarkable even after that. You know, people were saying, well, look, that's what he got 5 million out of FIFA. It's great.
Yeah.
So what was really happening underneath, though, was there was this facade around the finances and what was happening there. And it was way worse than anyone actually knew. You know, he was, as I was saying, he was drawing in all the future income, all the money that was accrued income. It was UEFA money, TV money. Any sponsor that actually was signing up with the FAI was told, if you pay that money now, you'll get a discount. You know, so the FAI was constantly cutting off its own legs, you know, and lowering its market rate for commercial deals because John Delaney needed that money in to plug these holes, and he wouldn't admit that the Vantage Club had been a problem until right near the end. He admitted there were some problems, you know, when they were relaunching the 10-year ticket scheme. But I think, no, like, it was inevitable ever since the Vantage Club scheme failed and the astronomical prices that they launched to that. Like, if they'd have targeted more reasonably, and things could have turned out differently there.
He cuts quite an isolated figure by the end of the book, where everybody wants to distance themselves from John Delaney, right from the opening chapter, where Eamon Dunphy is one of those at the much talked about 50th birthday party. Yeah, wasn't really mates with him, was only there with John Giles to support him. And yeah, he had tickets for Manchester United matches. Did you find that talking to people in writing the book, that actually everybody as quick as they could was running away from being a part of this?
Mainly, like, except for the odd standout, like John O'Regan, you know, the diehard loyalist, like, you know, even like John Giles, who would have been a confidant and someone he would, John Delaney would have turned to for advice on managerial issues, like even, you know, the managerial appointment of Stephen Kenny and Mick McCarthy, like we talk a bit about that. But like John Giles told me that John Delaney started well, but like all dictators, it went to his head.
Which I think, as he said on the show from last time as well.
That's a neat summation. Yeah, but most people, are distancing themselves entirely from John. And but he still has his loyalists, you know. And even now, I know he's ringing up people complaining about the book, you know. And there's still people that are very loyal to him and are making phone calls to people, letting them know that they're not happy that they're quoted in the book.
Right.
So that's his modus operandi hasn't changed since he left the FAI.
It did seem as though there was a bit of fatigue creeping in around the FAI, even being out in Abbottstown a couple of weeks ago for the EGM and talking to Roy Barrett and Gary Owens, that people are just a little bit fed up at this stage, 18 months in. I get the sense that this is going to bring it all very much back to life again.
Well, look, I was really concerned last November when the COSI report was finished and it wasn't published, because I'd expected it to be published. And I was like, oh my God, like, how are we going to write a book? I'd already agreed to do the book with Penguin at that stage. Yeah. I was like, how do we do a book without the COSI report? And thankfully, we were able to get it and a good bit of the Mazar. So I think what the book does, and also with interviews with people, like we've done over 120 interviews, and getting those, you know, there's hard financial figures in the book showing what happened with the FAI's money, who agreed what happened with these deals. And so now people, like when the FAI have their AGM, They should have the Cosi report, I think, in front of them. I don't think the legal issues around it are as big as people say. It's in the book now. You can read it there for yourself and decide who should be held accountable and what should change in terms of what happened before. Like one thing the new guys were criticised for is not having an audit and risk committee up and running, or a finance committee. Yeah. And that, you know, that's a serious issue. Like, it's a boring thing, corporate governance, but the committees that they did have under John Delaney's time, they're severely criticised by Cosi, and now we have a situation where they're not even set up unless they've happened in the last few days.
Yeah, well, we had Larry Bass on a couple of weeks ago, who's a part of that finance committee, saying, I've been on this for 6 months and literally nothing has happened. We haven't met.
Yeah. So that's extraordinary. Like, you know, given what's in Cosi and the criticism of how the committees were kept in the dark under Delaney, not to even have those committees meeting. Now, I'm not suggesting in any way that the new guys are Gary Owens. Like, there's no question about their bona fides or that they're acting like John Delaney. But, you know, it's basic corporate governance, and this stuff is boring, but it's very important to have those structures in place, because corporate governance is all about spreading responsibility and spreading oversight, you know. And, and if you'd had that during John Delaney's time, he would have been called out on a lot of the mad stuff that he got involved in.
I'm sure it's going to be a huge success, Mark. If you just look online, it's all anyone is talking about right now. Champagne Football, John Delaney and the Betrayal of Irish Football, the Inside Story. It's by Mark Tighe and Paul Roan from the Sunday Times, and it is in every bookstore right now. Great stuff, Mark. Thanks for coming in.
Nate.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, fueling the mischief in the beautiful game. Gamble responsibly. See dunlewy.net.
Welcome back to the Football Show. Nathan Murphy with you this evening here on Off the Ball. So, Shamrock Rovers' European adventure has come to an abrupt end. No fairy tale tonight for them in Tala. They've been beaten by Zlatan Ibrahimovic and AC Milan. Our very own Stephen Doyle was one of the few in Tala this evening watching the game. Stephen, from watching here in studio, it looked as though Shamrock Rovers gave a very good account of themselves and actually, you know, had chances in the first half to ask some questions of AC Milan.
Yep, they definitely did, Nathan. I thought they acquitted themselves pretty well. I think maybe a lot of people watching here were surprised at how sharp, how fit AC Milan looked, considering that they were in pre-season training. I think they played maybe three matches in pre-season. And to add to that, to the start of the game, which I mentioned to Stephen Baddy, we'll hear from him in a moment, but I thought the respect that they showed to Shamrock Rovers by picking a really strong team. I mentioned to you in the first update from the game against Cali, which was their last game at the end of last season on the 1st of August, they made just one change, and that was the enforced change, the Portuguese winger, of course, who's contracted coronavirus. Hopefully he's going to be okay, but they had to make that one enforced change. But apart from that, it was the strongest AC Milan team that they could have played. Of course, Ibrahimovic started as well. But I think Rovers, I think one thing they weren't expecting was maybe such a high press. Gary O'Neill, the Shamrock Rovers midfielder who we spoke to after the game as well, he also said to us that they weren't maybe expecting such a high press from a team who were just coming out of pre-season and hadn't yet started their league campaign. But with all that in mind, Shamrock Rovers did have their chances and they did get forward. Aaron Green had a couple of decent efforts in that first half. There was a good cross, or sorry, a good pass from Jack Byrne into the box in the first 10-15 minutes. Really brilliant slide rule pass from Jack Byrne, as we'd expect from him. McInniff let the ball kind of drift across his body to his left foot, and he had a crack which Donnarumma had to save. Green had another chance then, which I spoke to you about earlier on as well, where he got to the byline and the angle was so tight that he wasn't really going to trouble the goalkeeper. And you were just looking because Ronan Flynn had cut in off the right wing and he was into the box and he was shouting for the ball. And you just wonder if Green had to cut that ball back, Finn could have put that away. And then Finn probably had the best chance of the first half. Well, definitely Rovers' best move of that first half. I counted seven passes from around maybe 20 yards from Rovers' goal, right the way up to the left wing where Ferrugia put the cross in for Finn to head at goal. But the passing move was brilliant. They went from right to left. They cut in field, across the field. Everybody's involved. McInniff, Green, Ferrugia put the cross in. And unfortunately, a header from Ronan Flynn, which looked like it was going to go under the crossbar, saved by Donnarumma again. So he wasn't exactly, he didn't exactly have a quiet night, the AC Milan goalkeeper. But look, Nathan, the thing was, they were kind of caught between a rock and a hard place, I thought, Shamrock Rovers, because they were trying to play it their own way, which, as we've seen with them in the Premier Division this season, they like to play from the back. They don't like to give the possession away to the other team. and put themselves under pressure. But with a team like AC Milan, when you're pressing that high up the field, you're going to cough up possession, you're going to make mistakes, and that's what led to the two goals. Roberto Lopez gave away the ball for the first goal, and in the second half it was Lee Grace, his central defensive partner, and that was really because of the pressure AC Milan were putting Rovers under when they were in possession. And as you'll hear from the interview with Bradley, like I did say to him, you know, maybe you needed a bit of an out ball, maybe the likes of Aaron Green or somebody up there to take the pressure off him. Yeah. He was like, no, look, we were determined to play our own way. And I suppose he has a point, Nathan, as well, because if you're kicking that ball long and you're giving the ball away to a team as good as AC Milan, you're also going to put yourself under pressure. So that's what I mean by being caught between a rock and a hard place.
Let's hear from Stephen Bradley then. You were just talking to him in the last few minutes.
Stephen, were you surprised by how sharp their passing was and how fit they were considering they were in pre-season?
No, top players, they don't, when they're off, they don't be off. Like, you know, they have away from the club, but they're not off the training, personal trainers, they work. We've watched all the pre-season games, we knew they were right at it, you know. No, I'm not surprised at all.
As well, I was looking at their team that started their final Serie A match of last season. There was only one change. That shows you the respect they had for Rovers coming into this game as well.
Yeah, they showed us tremendous respect before the game and afterwards. Paolo Maldini and the coaches, really complimentary of how we play and what we do. And for us, that's really good. Like, you know, we need to take tonight now and build on that and learn from them.
Did Maldini speak to you himself?
Yeah, I spoke to him in the tunnel. And like I said, he was full of praise of the bravery that we showed and played the way we played and how we played. He watched a lot of our games and, like I said, full of confidence for the team, the players and us as a whole. So, like I said, we need to take the positives from this and move on.
There was one move just before half-time. I counted 7 passes from down near your own defensive area before Ronan Finn headed that goal. It was probably your best move of the game.
Yeah, I think we had a few of them, and like you said, that one was a really good move, and I think it was important. We spoke about coming here tonight and playing the way we play. We can't come away from that. Trust that and be brave, and I thought the players did that. You know, like I said, we created 3 really good chances from playing really good football against a top team. So overall, we're disappointed with one of the goals we give away, but overall, the players were excellent.
Just on the two goals, I know it was like 2 centre-backs obviously coughing up possession there, but you were trying to play from the back. Do you think at times maybe you could have gone long and try and get that out ball just to give yourselves a bit of time?
No, we were brave because you just said 10 minutes ago about the move that got us the chance. So if you don't play that way, you're chopping and changing and you don't really believe in what you do. We believe in what we do. And like you said, in the first half we get the chance, in the second half we get caught and we get punished. You have to understand that that's the chance you take when you play the way we play. But we don't chop and change every week. We are what we are and we play the way we play. And playing tonight against this level of opposition will only make us better at doing what we do.
Yeah, some good stuff there from Stephen Bradley. And listen, this is always the question around styles of football, that maybe the more pragmatic thing to do is, as you said, to go long, to try and not take those chances. But if you want to do something and you want to get players to buy in, you got to do it on the biggest occasion. What would the Shamrock Rovers players think of Stephen Bradley if he flipped all his ideas, everything they'd worked for all season, for one match?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, they did do something similar, Nathan, a few weeks ago against Bohemians. I was here for that game as well, the Dublin Derby, and they showed that they could maybe knock it long and have a player hold the ball up for them before the rest of the players kind of join them in the attack. But like I say, you know, as good as Bohemians are, they're not of the quality of AC Milan. And you know,
even for you, Steve-O, even for the Bulls fraternity to somehow suggest, you know, when they played AC Milan, they thought they could get away with playing the regular game plan, but when they went up against Bulls, that's when they really had to think about things. Dear God.
Listen. But look, what I'm saying is, you know, you could put against Bohemians where maybe you're not the amount of times that we saw AC Milan players putting. Every time a Rovers player got the ball, they were under pressure straight away. They didn't have any time on the ball whatsoever. It was quite impressive to watch from AC Milan. They were really, really top-notch. And I'm sure you, over the last couple of years, like myself, have done commentary on their games for Europa League nights. And they've been so poor, AC Milan, so average over the last couple of years. And I think Stefano Pioli has really got this team mouldering. And I'd expect them to go deep into this competition. They're a really quality side. And you would just wonder as well, Nathan, not to labour the point, about Rovers missing the supporters and all that, but wow, imagine if they had 7,000 or 8,000 Rovers fans here urging them on. That would have really given the players a real adrenaline boost, and perhaps it could have been a different game altogether.
Yeah, there were one or two supporters around the place. I saw a nice photograph there of Aaron Green's son, who managed to nab Zlatan Ibrahimovic's jersey that he was wearing during the game. It did look as though there were two players strolling around the pitch at their own pace. One was Zlatan, who got his goal. The other was Jack Byrne, who, it looked from what I could see, had a big night in a very big game for him against the sort of opposition he'd be facing if he was to get chances again in a green jersey.
Yeah, Stephen Kenny and Keith Andrews were only about 7 or 8 rows in front of me. They were watching the game very closely. I thought Jack Byrne did really well, but there were times as well, Nathan, I felt that the two midfielders, Kessier, who was excellent, and Benacer, the Algerian, who was absolutely wonderful, I thought. You know, and especially Kessier, because he's so physical. Jack Byrne was kind of maybe trying to look for fouls when there were times where I thought he could have protected the ball a little bit better. He showed too much of it to the opposition midfielders. I think sometimes he needs to get his body around the ball and try and win free kicks that way, because if you're getting shouldered by big guys like Kessier, the referee at this level, it's not going to give you anything. But I thought overall he had a pretty good night, and I'm sure the Republic of Ireland senior manager Stephen Kenny, who was watching closely, will be quite impressed as well.
All right, Stephen, great stuff as always. Thanks for that this evening. Rovers will have to go and focus obviously on domestic affairs. Where, how many points clear are they at Bohemians?
5 points, Nathan.
5 points, 5 points. But hey, listen, they had to change their style to play bowls. So listen, it's the moral victories, isn't it?
Sure is.
All right, great stuff as always from Stephen Doyle there out in Tallaght Stadium, where Shamrock Rovers were beaten 2-0 by AC Milan. But Dundalk are through. They won in Andorra this evening by 1-0. By all accounts, they were the better team, but made hard, hard work of it. And they now go to Moldova to take on Sheriff of Moldova in the next qualifying round of the Europa League. More live Premier League on Off the Ball this Sunday. We've got a big, big game. Stamford Bridge, Chelsea against Liverpool from 4:30 on Sunday. Myself and Kenny Cunningham will bring you live and exclusive coverage of that. Big game on Saturday for the Irish women's national team. They take on Germany in a Euro qualifier. We'll hear from the Irish manager, Vera Powell, next.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, fueling the mischief in the beautiful game. Gamble responsibly. See Dunluey.net.
So what a test for the Republic of Ireland this coming Saturday. Ireland face the task of taking on Germany, the world's second ranked side, in a Euro 2022 qualifier as it is now. The Republic of Ireland are currently top of their group. They have 4 wins from their 5 games and a draw in there as well, a single point ahead of Germany. But to put it in context, Germany have played 4 matches so far. They have scored 31 goals and haven't conceded any. That's right, their 4 games, a 5-0 win, 2 8-0 wins and a 10-0 victory. It is a huge test for Vera Powell's side. She spoke to the media yesterday and gave her thoughts on the game.
Germany is ranked 2nd in the world and arguably at this moment by far the best team. They come from a dip after 2011, after their own World Cup. They had a period that the players, let's say the stars, were retiring, there were new players in, and before they realized themselves, their balance was gone. So they had a difficult time under guidance of Steffi Jones, that was very difficult for her. Now, Martina Voss just came in on the moment that she could bring in new players, young players. The dynamic came back into the squad because of that. And what we see now is that they play a game that is very, how do you say that, they dominate every part of the game. And they are capable to play in with a lot of variety. Their fullbacks are coming over, they've got balls over the top, they play in between the lines, so, and it's all connected. They've done a really good job. So indeed, we have to expect that this will be a very, very difficult game for us. We will do everything we can to stop them from playing their variety. But yeah, if we are capable of, we are ranked 32, they are ranked 2, and at this moment better than USA, in my opinion. So we have to be very realistic. And even though we don't plan to defend a lot, because we plan to play an open game, we know that we will be pushed back.
Saturday's game will probably see your team without the ball for large parts of the game. How important will concentration be on Saturday?
Yeah, asking the question is giving the answer. Huh? the moment you lose your concentration for 1 second, they will score. And if we cannot close the gaps, they will score also. And if we cannot get counter their runners, they will score also. So it will be difficult. They're just, again, they are the best team in the world, and we're ranked 32. So we are very realistic. But that doesn't mean we're Irish, and we do everything what we can to put something against it. But please be realistic, everybody.
How are you doing? Just looking at the group, obviously Ireland top of the group, unbeaten in the group. Obviously, you know, the task at hand against Germany, the top seeds. The Ukraine game, you've talked about.
It's great to be top of the group, but we all know why we are top of the group.
Yeah. And I know you've talked about the Ukraine game being the most important game, and that is the, it's all geared up towards that game next month. But if the team were to lose on Saturday, is there a concern that maybe the confidence could be dented going into that Ukraine game?
The confidence, no. No, because we will learn so much out of it, of our limits. That is a good thing of games like this. We had a lot of trouble organizing it. We've assembled in Germany. That's why we have this call. We're not face-to-face to each other. we could have postponed it. But why would you postpone it if you have facilities like here and everybody flew into this bubble here? So the good thing of having this game now is that our limits are really tested on Saturday. We know what, after Saturday, we know exactly what we can and what we cannot do on the top level and what we have to improve. And that brings them more readiness for next month. If we would have postponed this game or would have pushed pressure on UEFA to get it to February, we wouldn't have had this experience for next month. So you can even see this game as preparation for the Ukraine game. And that is what we said to each other. We want to have this game, whatever matters, unless it's really not possible, because we want to have this game in our legs. We want to know our limits so that we are better prepared for next month.
The fact that Germany are not bringing their full squad to Montenegro, has that been talked about among the players? And do you think that that can serve as a source of motivation for you on Saturday?
The first question, I don't know. We did not talk in the group about it, but you all know. Because, of course, we hear that people talk about it. They know everything. If it's a motivation, probably. Probably, because they rate us higher than Montenegro. They rate us. That is good. And they see us also to develop their squad under the pressure that we give. So, yeah, it does motivate the players, I think, but we haven't discussed that with them.
Mm. And my final question is, do you see it as your job to instill belief in the players that they can get a result, be it a draw or a win on Saturday, or do you think that the players have that among themselves already?
That is a difficult question. I try to be realistic in a way that we get the best out of us, and then we'll see where we get.
Mm.
Is that an answer?
We
are preparing to get the best out of us to give Germany the best game ever. And then we'll see if that is good enough to get a result. It would not be realistic to say like, we go on to win or we go on to draw. The game itself will show how far we are. And we prepare the best way we can and with all our energy, all our power, and the place will be ready. And that is why I say, I think that you will be proud of them, whatever the result.
Yeah, pretty daunting task ahead for Vera Powell and the Republic of Ireland ahead of the Euro qualifier against Germany on Saturday. Just to let you know that Justin Thomas continues to lead at the US Open in the clubhouse on 5-under, Patrick Reed on 4-under, Rory McIlroy on 3-under, Shane Lowry 3-over after 12 holds. Lots more on that on OTB AM from 7:30 tomorrow morning with Adrian Annone. You'll get that on the OTB Sports app. 10:45 for the full show, Ian Wright and Saul Campbell, and then back here on the radio at 7 tomorrow, Brian O'Driscoll looking ahead to Leinster against Saracens and Ulster to lose. You will get commentary of that game on OTB this Sunday on air, earlier time at 12:30. Neil Tracy and Bernard Jackman at that game for us. We'll also have Chelsea against Liverpool. Tom Dunn is up next. Good luck.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, fueling the mischief in the beautiful game. Gamble responsibly. See dunlewy.net.